listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the April 2021 issue of Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair Part A. Here's the continuation of this month's cover story, Opening Moves, by Hermione Hobie. Famously, sales of chess sets soared by 125% in the weeks after the show premiered. This is what I mean about how I think in 5 years I'll understand, Taylor Joy Peels. I don't think you can be an even kind of sane person and be walking around like... She does a parodic hair flip of self-satisfaction and puts on a haughty voice to intone, "I have reinvigorated the game of chess." Just that morning, one of her best friends had told her that their boyfriend was playing on chess.com against a Bethbot. "A what now?" "Oh yeah, on chess.com, you can play Beth Harmon at different ages." The Bethbots have, alas, been disabled. At the heart of the Queen's Gambit is an almost childlike truth, one true at least of chess. Talent will take you to the top. Life, of course, ain't like that. Least of all, the oversubscribed, fickle world of movie making, in which talent is notoriously little guarantee of success. I ask Taylor Joy how she squares the immeasurability and subjectivity of acting with the binary nature of chess, black and white, win or lose. Her answer is humble. "I've always followed the character." Earlier, when she said, "They're not my hands," she meant it. It gets a bit existentially confusing when you're living for somebody else. Taylor Joy's characters are real enough for her to mourn their loss once filming has wrapped. For nearly each one, she keeps some article of theirs as a memento. In the case of Beth, it seems telling that Taylor Joy kept not one thing, but many, several hats, various outfits. "She's a voice that I've had in my head and in my life for a very long time," she says, adding, "There were some scenes that were just so close to the bone. They were experiences that I had had or that I had been witness to, and it was so real." I ask whether there was one scene that got particularly close. "Yes, yeah, her waking up in Paris was really very close." She's referring to the dramatic flash forward that opens the series. Beth awakens with a horrified lurch at the insistent knocking of a porter who's come to summon her to her match downstairs. At the moment, Beth is in a bathtub, fully clothed and soaked after a drunken night. "Been there," Taylor Joy says grimly, not ready to talk about it in more detail. "Been there." Has she been able to let Beth go? "You're hitting me in the heart," Taylor Joy says. "It's complicated. I don't know. Different characters have different grieving periods. Some of them don't ever really go away. I have a feeling Beth is going to be one of those ones." "Hi, love," Taylor Joy sings out. "We're meeting for the second time, and now it's in Joe Biden's America, a phrase that's been playing through my head, half hopefully, half ironically." Taylor Joy tells me that she and a bunch of castmates from the David O. Russell movie watched the inauguration in the makeup trailer. "The sense of optimism," she says, "was beautiful." "This feels like the intake of a fresh breath," she says, adding, "For the love of God, I would love it if we could start taking care of the planet." The Bernie memes are still flying after a photograph of the Vermont senator looking stalwart and chilly at the inauguration seized the American imagination. On her Instagram stories, Taylor Joy has just posted a still of the final match of the Queen's Gambit. Except, instead of the formidable Russian player Borgov, Beth's facing off with Bernie in his mittens. Is she a Sanders fan? Yeah, absolutely, she says, primarily because he cares about the planet. He was the first world leader that I saw really jump up and be like, she mimes a frantic wave, hello, our home is burning. We should probably do something about that. Taylor Joy has come of age at an exceptional time. While dire and interlocking crises occupy the world at large, the American movie industry has been undergoing an overdue reckoning with racism and misogyny. I didn't realize just how lucky I was until maybe year three, she admits, when I broached the subject of sexism. But I've been blessed to work with men who never made me feel like I didn't have a seat at the table. I was always treated as a serious collaborator and somebody that was as passionate as the director was about executing this vision. Nonetheless, she found the 4 years of the previous administration, including its grotesque misogyny, hard to take. It was just like, wait a second, am I in the minority in believing that everybody should have equal rights? Am I in the minority of believing that you shouldn't touch a woman if she doesn't give you her permission? After our interviews, both Taylor Joy and the Queen's Gambit will win Golden Globes. I ask how she's dealing with the buzz ahead of time. Is it awful to say I don't think about it? She says quietly. Look, any kind of recognition for your work is wonderful and truly moving, but I have to show up for my movie and my director and my friends. If I were consistently thinking about things like that, I don't know how healthy my mind would be. But she has an important clarification. I want to be quite clear about something, which is when I say I walk away or I don't think about it anymore, it's never because I'm ungrateful for any of it. I just really think that I won't be able to do my best work if I start believing I'm anything more than human, because people watch characters for the humanity. In short, the point of stars is not just that they're looked at. You have to have a connection to real life. If you don't have a true heart and a true place of emotions to come from, how on earth are you going to give life to a character? The Rise and Fall of a Bitcoin Billionaire. Arthur Hayes created a cryptocurrency exchange that has traded trillions. Now he's wanted by U.S. authorities, and insiders wonder whether he and his partners are villains or victims of a two-tiered justice system that favors big banks over brash outsiders. By Adam Surowski. Photographs by Adam Ferguson. Opening photo, crazy rich expat. Prosecutors have brought charges for failing to establish an anti-money laundering program against BitMEX co-founder Arthur Hayes, shown here in Singapore in 2018. Arthur Hayes lives large, like Bobby Axelrod, in billions large. Just replace New York with Hong Kong and infuse it with a dose of Silicon Valley, where unicorns spring from the minds of irrepressible company founders, and, well, you get the picture. One minute, Hayes is hitting the powder in Hokkaido. The next, he's crushing it on a subterranean squash court in central Hong Kong's Wall Street. And all the while, he keeps one eye trained on an obscure-sounding currency exchange that he built out of thin air and through which more than $3 trillion has flowed. Screen star handsome and fabulously wealthy, the African-American banker turned maverick personifies the contemporary fintech pioneer. But the feds describe Hayes differently, a wanted man who flouted the law by operating in the shadows of the financial markets. Hayes' indictment was unsealed in October, and he remains at large in Asia as prosecutors in New York hope to arrest him and try him on two felony counts, which carry a possible penalty of 10 years in prison. This is a tale of new money versus old, financial whiz kids upstaging banking's old guard, and American authorities attempting to apply 20th century laws to 21st century innovation. Prosecutors allege that Hayes and his business partners violated the Bank Secrecy Act by failing to implement and maintain an adequate anti-money laundering program to weed out bad actors and dirty money. Meanwhile, Hayes' colleagues in the cryptocurrency world believe he is being punished for building an ingenious product that has baffled lawmakers, bedeviled regulators, and, once it became wildly popular, posed a threat to some of the market's biggest players. Adding to the chorus of voices are some high-powered legal experts who consider the case United States of America versus Arthur Hayes to be largely unprecedented. At a time when the SEC is seemingly doing the bidding of Wall Street titans, eager to punish the unwashed masses of day traders for scuttling banks and hedge funds, trading positions on GameStop and other stocks, Hayes might just be patient zero when it comes to exposing the hypocrisy in high finance that is now coming into sharp relief. The crypto gold rush. Hayes, 35, went silent in October. But the crypto condor has not always been so elusive. Born to middle-class parents who worked for General Motors and were beholden to the ever-changing fortunes of the auto giant, he split his formative years between Detroit and Buffalo, where his mother, Barbara, moved mountains to get her gifted son into Nichols School, a leafy private institution founded in 1892. He succeeded at everything, from his studies to the sports field to making lasting friendships, reads a testimony featuring Barbara on one of the fundraising pages of the school's website. Nichols gave him the setting, the stimulation, and at one point the scholarship to thrive. Hayes, in return, has given back. Underwriting a scholarship, that ensures a deserving student will be able to experience the excellence of a Nichols education and the lifelong benefits it brings. After attending the Wharton School of Business, he headed off to Hong Kong, where he worked at Deutsche Bank and Citibank as a market maker for exchange-traded funds, or ETFs, hybrid securities that, not unlike mutual funds, diversify an investor's risk, but can be traded like stocks. Hayes was just hitting his stride when a pink slip arrived in May 2013. "Bankers tell you everybody has a bullet with their name on it," he explained one afternoon over tea at the Marina Bay Sands in Singapore, the iconic hotel featured in the finale of Crazy Rich Asians. He was wearing his standard attire, skin-tight T-shirt, jeans, and a pricey timepiece, a Hublot Big Bang. "I wasn't married, had no kids, no obligations. I had been an investment banker, so I wasn't sleeping on the streets. I wanted to build something." I interviewed Hayes and some of his cohorts in Hong Kong, Singapore, and New York in 2018 and 2019. Since the October indictment, I have spoken at length with insiders who know and are in communication with Hayes and his two indicted business partners, Ben Dilo and Sam Reed. A number of these sources requested anonymity so as not to prejudice pending legal proceedings. On the advice of counsel, Hayes, Dilo, and Reed opted not to comment for this story. But back to that pink slip. 8 years ago, Hayes, out of a job, decided to go solo, combining his knack for designing novel financial instruments with a newfound passion, cryptocurrency, specifically Bitcoin. Cryptocurrency, it bears repeating, is a digital form of payment and a method for storing value. It relies on a secure, decentralized ledger, called a blockchain, to record transactions, manage the issuance of new coins or tokens, and prevent fraud and counterfeiting. Though there are thousands of such currencies, Bitcoin is by far the most durable, despite having a dubious backstory involving an enigmatic creator named Satoshi Nakamoto, whose existence and identity have never been established. Bitcoin's blockchain was designed so that only 21 million virtual coins could ever be mined. That kind of verifiable scarcity, in contrast with the tendency of the world's central bankers to print money, whether in a pandemic or whenever it is politically expedient, has contributed to the currency's precipitous rise in price. From less than a penny in 2009 to more than $54,000 in February 2021. In 2020 alone, the coin rose more than 300% in value. At first, Hayes was a nobody among crypto's dank sea of tax evaders, drug dealers, arms traffickers, child pornographers, contrarian libertarians, and wanker bankers pining for a return to the gold standard. They were united by their disenchantment with old-school banking and its laggardly pace, onerous verification requirements for opening accounts and moving money, and a sense that the relationship between big finance and big government had become entirely too cozy. In their view, governments, starting with the U.S. and rippling outward, believed and acted as though they had a monopoly on money and resisted the crypto uprising, in which people were investing in reputedly anonymous digital assets to make a profit, hide their wealth, flip off the establishment, or some combination thereof. The crypto gold rush initially attracted three types of players: visionaries with gold-plated resumes, boiler room sharks who could recite just enough buzzwords to BS their way through a capital raise, and the inevitable parasites who latch on and try to feed off the others. Not surprisingly, Hayes ran with the smart set. "I bought my first Bitcoin from Arthur in 2013, recalled Jehan Chu, a New Jersey native who followed a circuitous route to the Pacific Rim. While an undergrad at Johns Hopkins, he taught himself how to code just in time for the first dot-com boom in the late 1990s. After he'd worked at a small web development shop in New York, Sotheby's came calling, looking to Chu to help the auction house grow its digital presence. "We famously sold the Declaration of Independence in 2000, he exclaimed, referring to one of the last remaining copies in private hands. After the $8.14 million transaction, the online market dipped, and Chu moved to Hong Kong to help Sotheby's cater to ultra-rich Asian clients, many of whom had a seemingly insatiable appetite for art and artifacts. In his spare time, Chu organized brainstorming sessions for enthusiasts of digital currencies. What started with five people at a smoky bar in Shengwan, however, quickly grew into a community of thousands. By 2016, he told me, Chu had turned his compulsion into a career, establishing Kinetic, a venture capital firm that trades crypto and has invested in more than 150 companies. Meanwhile, he watched in amazement as his friend Hayes took the crypto world by storm, going from an artisanal trader to an industry titan. Arthur Hayes started small with arbitrage, buying Bitcoin in one market and then selling it at a premium in another. Things were humming along until October 2013, when he had problems accessing coins he had sent to Mt. Gox, a Tokyo-based Bitcoin exchange that helped patrons convert their holdings into fiat money. Traditional legal tender, such as the dollar, euro, pound, or yuan. In early 2014, Mt. Gox declared that hackers had stolen nearly $500 million from its coffers. Unlike most other depositors, some 24,000, Hayes managed to get his money out, and in the process learned an important lesson. Exchanges constitute a single point of failure in the otherwise secure Bitcoin ecosystem. Mt. Gox might have been the most infamous such hack, but dozens of exchanges have been hit, and untold billions in Bitcoin and other cryptocurrencies have vanished. Hayes, however, decided to take his money elsewhere. When he heard Bitcoin was trading significantly higher on the Chinese mainland, he bought a bundle, transferred the coins to an exchange in China, and swapped them for yuan, literally lugging around a backpack containing stacks of banknotes. Over a period of days, he recounted, I physically crossed the border by bus to Shenzhen with some friends, had lunch, and came back over the border carrying legal amounts of cash. It was a neat trick and relatively lucrative. But the real-world hazards of schlepping real money across international borders got him thinking, why not build an online exchange where people could really profit from their Bitcoin by using derivatives? A derivative is a financial contract whose value is based on the performance of an agreed-upon underlying asset, in this case, cryptocurrency. It was an idea that would require serious technological chops, not only to build, but to persuade a deeply skeptical crypto community that Hayes had solved for the security and accounting lapses that had plagued earlier exchanges. Bitcoin and beer. In January 2014, Hayes arranged a meeting at a swank rooftop watering hole with Ben Dilo, a brainy British mathematician and programmer whose classmates at Oxford reportedly voted him the most likely to become a millionaire and the second most likely to wind up in prison. After graduating in 2005, he worked for IBM, two hedge funds, and after moving to Hong Kong, J.P. Morgan. When Hayes and Dilo got together, little about them suggested they would storm the ramparts. On paper, both had establishment CVs, elite educations, and stints at blue-chip companies. Yet, each was an outlier. Hayes, the scholarly son of auto workers, had forsaken the regimented and highly regulated world of investment banking for crypto's Wild West, where rules were made on the fly and regulations were few. D'Lo, according to Sir Jonathan Bate, provost of Oxford's Worcester College, overcame great difficulties in his school career to win a place at Oxford from a local state school. In fact, as the child of a civil engineer father and schoolteacher mother, he was expelled from 3 grade schools before he was diagnosed with Asperger's. At Oxford, where he double majored in math and computer science, he earned what the Brits call a double first, graduating with a perfect GPA in both subjects. As the pair mapped out what it would take to turn Hayes' vision into reality, D'Lo, an expert in the back-office work of designing complex algorithms and high-speed trading systems, said they needed a front-end web developer to handle the consumer-facing side of things. Hayes knew just the guy, a young American coder and tech evangelist named Sam Reed, whom Hayes had met after a speech Reed had given in which he'd warned his aspiring techie audience not to join startups, whose owners often exploited and stiffed their coders. When Hayes pitched Reed on his idea for a Bitcoin derivatives exchange, Reed, disregarding his own advice, signed on immediately. The youngest of 3 boys, Reed had grown up in Manitowoc, Wisconsin. His father had been a network administrator for the Air Force, and his mother worked as a newspaper editor. There were plenty of old computers lying around the Reed household, and Sam managed to get them working. By age 12, he had a paying gig, debugging and repairing PCs for friends and neighbors. Reed was much younger than Hayes and D'Lo, yet he had been at the crypto game the longest. By 2009, his senior year at Washington and Lee, the self-described Bitcoin hipster was mining Bitcoin on his laptop at a time when the currency was next to worthless. Reed racked up roughly 100 Bitcoins along the way, but in the process of reformatting a hard drive, accidentally erased the private keys required to access them, rendering his cash untouchable. Today, those coins would be worth $5.4 million. Reed was less institutional and more peripatetic than Hayes and D'Lo. He worked for a large defense contractor, found the corporate world suffocating, and bided his time at a couple of startups and freelance gigs before finding his way to Hong Kong in 2013. In an online career forum with his alma mater, taped while sitting in a hut in Thailand, Reed shared crypto business tips. Among his insights, in a gold rush, you don't want to mine the gold, you want to sell the shovels. At one point, Reed remarked that he'd been toying with the idea of building an online exchange to trade cryptocurrencies, explaining his rationale. If you can cut the banks out, you cut most of the complexity out. You cut out a lot of where U.S. law kind of gets involved with anti-money laundering, know your customer, KYC kind of stuff, and you get rid of a lot of the fraud, because all this, you know, internet money is actually verifiable, you know, by design. Hayes, D'Lo, and Reed began working in earnest on what they termed the Bitcoin Mercantile Exchange, or BitMEX. Hayes was the CEO, D'Lo the COO, and Reed the CTO, Chief Technology Officer. As buttoned down as those titles sound, BitMEX at first was just 3 dudes with laptops working out of a Starbucks at Jardine House, a 70s-era Hong Kong skyscraper adorned with porthole windows. At night, they'd retreat to Hayes' apartment with beers from 7-Eleven. A sophisticated casino. BitMEX was billed as a peer-to-peer trading platform that offers leveraged contracts that are bought and sold in Bitcoin. It allowed users to effectively bet on the currency's future price with leverage of up to a dizzying 100-to-1. Translation, a customer with $10,000 in a BitMEX account could seamlessly execute a trade worth a cool $1 million. The lure of the exchange lay in the fact that people could make big money by putting in relatively modest crypto seed money. In a blog entry on the BitMEX site, Hayes mused, trading without leverage is like driving a Lamborghini in first gear. You know, it's safer, but that's not why you bought it. His friend Jehan Chu compared BitMEX to the NASDAQ. If the NASDAQ was located in Las Vegas, when pressed about the potentially catastrophic downside of letting people trade so much on margin, Chu insisted that personal responsibility has always been central to the crypto ethos. You put on 100 times? Make sure you read the fine print. Mommy's not here to make sure you don't fall off the skateboard. Hartaj Singh Sawhney is another one of the colorful characters in the American expat crypto circle. With a turban made, in his words, from secret fabric and an eponymous line of clothing, which he describes as Burning Man by way of Punjab, the first-generation Sikh American began hosting Bitcoin meetups a decade ago in Vegas, where early attendees included aspiring magicians and poker players. Now based in Kiev, which he contends is far more hospitable to digital currencies than the United States, he helps build and secure blockchain companies. Sawhney has been sympathetic to BitMEX's business model, insisting they are running a pretty sophisticated casino environment. But I'm a free market guy. In my book, BitMEX should be able to put up whatever. Their terms are very clear. The birth of BitMEX 6 years ago was perfectly timed, yet dangerously fraught. In the eyes of U.S. authorities, Bitcoin was then transitioning from being the favored currency of bad actors, exemplified by the 2013 takedown of Silk Road, the notorious black market for drugs and guns for hire, to being an investment-grade asset that institutional players were starting to buy as a safeguard against inflation, and for its promise of outsized returns. Hayes, DeLo, and Reed were in the catbird seat and began to accumulate serious wealth. All three are billionaires, according to sources familiar with their finances. At the same time, though, they were outsiders, suddenly playing in an arena that insiders were looking to co-opt. Their high-speed, highly leveraged offerings harkened back to the kinds of potentially toxic financial instruments that would eventually draw scrutiny from regulators and later generate laughs in Adam McKay's 2015 film, The Big Short, based on the Michael Lewis bestseller. Remember synthetic collateralized debt obligations? For all its upside, BitMEX came with a vertiginous risk. This stuff is happening very, very fast. It didn't exist 10 years ago, explained J. Christopher Giancarlo, who served at the powerful Commodity Futures Trading Commission under President Obama and later as the CFTC chairman under President Trump. Regulation always follows innovation, and sometimes in democracies it follows a little further behind other jurisdictions. For years, Giancarlo pressed Congress to enact a comprehensive regulatory framework to cover the cryptosphere. Instead, legislators have relied on laws from the 1930s, the Securities Exchange Act and Commodity Exchange Act, which were later amended in the wake of the 2008 financial crisis. Even so, the rules remain woefully outdated. And so regulators, according to Giancarlo, must determine how pioneering platforms, like Hayes's, are regulated, if at all. There are something like 8,000 new instruments that have been identified, he said. In each case, regulators have to ask, do they fall on CFTC's side of the ledger, the SEC's side of the ledger, or nobody's side of the ledger? Next photo, blockchain brain Jan Chu, who established the Kinetic Venture Capital firm and bought his first Bitcoin from Hayes at a Singapore hotel during a cryptocurrency conference in 2018. Magical thinking. Understanding what BitMEX was selling is perhaps less important than whom the company was selling to. In our early conversations, Hayes insisted that BitMEX was careful to have no American customers, and that technological barriers, such as blocking US IP addresses, kept American clients off the platform and stateside regulators at bay. But US officials said that wasn't the case. It did not escape their attention that BitMEX had plenty of American depositors, many of whom disguised their location by using virtual private network software. They were flocking to BitMEX by the thousands, and even though Hayes is a product of the banking establishment, where whole departments are dedicated to enforcing anti-money laundering and know-your-customer requirements, his immersion into the deeply libertarian world of crypto seems to have blinded him to certain realities. Among them, U.S. authorities have wide reach, long memories, and an affinity for knocking people down to size, especially brash upstarts. Arthur is an iconoclast, his friend Meltem Demirers contended. He's not afraid to be controversial, and you know, history is not kind to these people. As chief strategy officer of CoinShares, a digital asset investment firm, Demirers has been dubbed the Sheryl Sandberg of crypto, which sounds like a reductionist label created by those she terms pseudo-intellectual F-boys. Demirers was born in the Netherlands to Turkish parents, moved to the U.S. when she was 10, and studied math and economics at Rice. She got her MBA at MIT, where she was taught fintech and blockchain strategy, specialties she later brought to students at Oxford. It is not hard to see why Hayes and Demirers became friends and kindred spirits. "I feel like an outsider," she remarked, "in the sense that I'm female. I'm not funded by Silicon Valley. My mommy and daddy aren't rich. I don't have the same background as many people in this industry. And when I walk into rooms, people still raise their eyebrows." The same could be said of Hayes, who, as Demirers sees it, didn't have famous venture capital backers. He didn't have the advantages that other people had. Hayes's original sin might be that he refused to play the game. He didn't care about the charade and the optics and the bullshit and Silicon Valley and the think tanks, all the stupid shit you do for prestige. He just didn't care. Sometimes people's greatest qualities are also their biggest downfall. Next photos, crypto trio, the billionaire co-founders of BitMEX, who are now under federal indictment. Ben Dilo at company headquarters in Hong Kong, 2019. Hayes, Sam Reed, and Dilo in Dublin, 2014. Reed on his laptop in Croatia on the day the firm began trading, 2014. BitMEX incorporated in the Seychelles, a move that allowed the startup to move fast and minimize its tax exposure while Western governments struggle to even understand, much less create a way to govern, the newfangled financial instruments and market it was building. In a 2015 investor presentation, Hayes made the point that Bitcoin derivatives are completely unregulated worldwide. Regulators are still trying to tackle the exchanging of fiat and Bitcoin. That might have been magical thinking. There were no rules in the beginning, and governments weren't interested in articulating the rules, Chu remembered. You would go to them and ask for guidance and get nothing. Is this illegal? No answer. It was only after the fact, he said, that cryptic strictures emerged to police crypto, usually in response to some infraction that had not been previously articulated by regulators. But where Chu saw chaos, Hayes saw opportunity. For nearly a year after its launch, BitMEX's business was flat. Some days we had no trades, Hayes remembered. No one bought or sold. The fees from trading on the platform barely covered the server bill, which Reed paid with his credit card. While Hayes and Elo stayed in Hong Kong, Reed got married and moved back to the States, settling in Milwaukee, where he operated out of a co-working space. The time zone difference, however, worked in their favor. Reed and Delo, in signature startup fashion, took turns being on call, addressing customer support issues 24/7. The company's fortunes changed when, in late 2015, it started offering customers 100x, five times as much leverage as its closest competitor. Political volatility the following year, with Brexit and the election of Trump, increased crypto's trading volume. Come 2017, BitMEX had to bring on 30 employees to cope with the explosion in trading. The firm moved into new office space, which it would soon outgrow. By 2018, BitMEX had become a high-stakes bazaar, moving billions every day. During one of our meetings, Hayes commented, "We are the biggest trading platform in the world by volume. That's anyone who trades a crypto product." BitMEX, he said, was one of the most liquid exchanges in the world, regardless of asset class. By that measure, it was in the same league as the NASDAQ, as well as the New York, London, and Tokyo stock exchanges. Within 4 short years, Hayes's scrappy casino had become, in gambling terms, the house. Since the indictment was unsealed in October, BitMEX has taken a huge hit. Its market share and trading volume have dropped precipitously. Sharks and Lambos. In May 2018, on the opening day of Consensus, the crypto world's equivalent of the Consumer Electronics Show, Hayes pulled up to the Hilton in Midtown Manhattan in an orange Lamborghini and tweeted, "Did you see my ride today at #Consensus2018? A close friend insisted he was simply lampooning the thousands of attendees gathered inside the hotel. Investors who talked a big game about cashing in on crypto, but who had really only succeeded in burning through millions in venture capital on harebrained schemes and ICOs, initial coin offerings. Still, looking back, the Lambo Gambit might well have been the moment, more than any other, when Hayes painted a bullseye on his back. True, the firm's partners had differing approaches to their images and their booming business. Hayes, who didn't mind ruffling feathers, reveled in the role of financial renegade. Reed kept an extremely low profile, a secret billionaire on paper, walking the streets of Milwaukee. Delo, however, seemed to hunger for mainstream acceptance. When BitMEX was declared the world's largest cryptocurrency exchange in 2018, a string of British newspapers dubbed him the UK's youngest self-made billionaire. That October, he donated £5 million British pounds to Oxford's Worcester College, and a few months later signed the Giving Pledge, designed by Bill and Melinda Gates and Warren Buffett, as an open invitation for billionaires to publicly commit to giving the majority of their wealth to philanthropy. In a letter explaining his decision, he wrote, "As a schoolboy in Britain, aged 16, I was asked to list my ambitions for the future. I answered concisely, computer programmer, internet entrepreneur, millionaire. I have been incredibly fortunate to exceed those goals, and I'm grateful to be in a position to sign this pledge." 2 years ago, BitMEX leased the 45th floor of Cheung Kong Center, the most expensive real estate in Hong Kong, and home to Goldman Sachs, Barclays, Bloomberg, and Bank of America. Hayes, Delo, and Reed were literally moving in on the establishment. But ever eager to make a statement, BitMEX kitted out its office with an accessory none of those stodgy legacy companies had, a large aquarium inhabited, appropriately enough, by live sharks. The tangle in Taipei. In the summer of 2019, the amount of money moving through BitMEX was staggering. On June 27th, the company announced it had set a new daily record, trading $16 billion. 2 days later, Hayes tweeted, $1 trillion traded in a year. The stats don't lie. BitMEX ain't nothing to F with. At Nouriel, I'll see you on Wednesday. The man he was tweeting at was Nouriel Roubini, a respected NYU economics professor and BitMEX's fiercest critic. Dubbed Dr. Doom for having predicted the 2007 subprime mortgage crisis, as well as the stock market plunge and global recession that followed, Roubini had sat on President Clinton's Council of Economic Advisors and served at the Treasury Department, the International Monetary Fund, and the World Bank. In other words, he was about as establishment as Hayes was not. On July 3rd, the pair faced off on stage at the Asia Blockchain Summit in what was publicized as the Tangle in Taipei, taking their seats at the theme from as the theme from Rocky blared overhead. The professor spoke first and went straight for the jugular. Shitty behavior occurs in this particular industry. Con men, criminals, scammers, snake oil salesmen, and so on. Next to me is a gentleman who works with degenerate gamblers and retail suckers, non-accredited investors. Roubini didn't hold back. There's a whole nice Twitter feed called BitMEX Wrecked. Wrecked means effed in the ass, where every other second somebody has been liquidated by these guys, and thousands of them have gone into financial ruin. He accused the company of bucking regulations, insisting that with BitMEX, everybody gets wrecked, with the exception of Hayes and his colleagues, who, Roubini said, reap commissions and fees and maintain a liquidation fund that profits off of people going bankrupt. Hayes countered, with whataboutism, BitMEX, 100 times leverage. So what? You could trade this type of leverage anywhere you want to go. In the United States, we have things called exchange-traded funds, ETFs. There was a great one, and it was based on the idea of short volatility. A one-day spike in February 2018 in the most highly regulated financial market in the world, highly liquid, and all these nice banks, people with suits on, went to nice universities, and your ETF went to effing zero, wrecked. It was a curious line of argument for someone who got his start in finance by building and pushing ETFs. Hayes, in fact, had many fans in the auditorium that day, people who believed that he, like Facebook's Mark Zuckerberg, had created an entire marketplace from scratch, an influential, secure, and highly profitable platform that people had never known they needed. As Hayes spoke, though, other parallels with Zuckerberg were unmistakable. The arrogance, the disdain for authority, and the tone-deafness that veered toward self-sabotage. All of it was on display in Taipei. When the moderator questioned BitMEX's decision to register in the Seychelles, where it was suggested there are no regulations, Hayes went off. Maybe the U.S.-centric Roubini thinks the New York Department of Financial Services and New York Attorney General is the only game in town, and we need to, you know, bow down and take an ass-effing from the U.S. government just because it's regulated. Now, I don't know. That's really not my game. When asked if he might concede that U.S. and European regulatory authorities are on a slightly different plane than those in the Seychelles, Hayes remarked, it just cost more to bribe them. And how much was Hayes paying to bribe the Seychelles authorities? His answer, a coconut. A few weeks later, Dr. Doom blasted back with a scathing op-ed titled The Great Crypto Heist. In it, he raised red flags about systematic illegality in offshore exchanges. Still fuming from Taipei, he trained his ire on BitMEX and its CEO, accusing them of sketchy business practices, such as using an internal for-profit trading desk to front-run their own clients and deriving up to half of their profits from liquidations, the suggestion being that BitMEX is highly incentivized to screw over the very people who trade on the platform. Then, Rubini went for the kill shot. BitMEX insiders revealed to me that this exchange is also used daily for money laundering on a massive scale by terrorists and other criminals from Russia, Iran, and elsewhere. The exchange does nothing to stop this, as it profits from these transactions. He closed by shaming regulators who he said have been asleep at the wheel as the crypto cancer has metastasized. Demirers had a more charitable view of the tussle in Taipei. That's an example of Arthur being a showman and creating a scene and understanding, you know, the economics of attention. She marveled at how total strangers, even those who got wrecked on BitMEX, would approach Hayes on the street and want to give him a hug. For so many people, Arthur is like a cult figure, she said. He believed that we, the crypto crowd, were going to change the world. He believed in the monetary revolution. He believed that what we're doing as an industry is profound. But he also believed that it should be fun, and it should be irreverent, and we should be able to laugh at ourselves, and that we should be able to call out the bullshit. Coup de grace. At 6 a.m. on the morning of October 1st, 2020, FBI agents pulled up to a large colonial in a comfortable Boston suburb. Records show the house had been purchased a year before by a Delaware LLC. The property's real owner, Sam Reed, was taken away in handcuffs. Hours later, Audrey Strauss, the acting U.S. attorney for the Southern District of New York, and William F. Sweeney, Jr., head of the FBI's New York field office, announced the indictment of BitMEX's founders, Hayes, DeLo, and Reed, along with their close friend and first hire, Gregory Dwyer. The men were charged with violating and conspiring to violate the Bank Secrecy Act by willfully failing to establish, implement, and maintain an adequate anti-money laundering program. Each count carries a maximum penalty of 5 years behind bars. Reed, the only defendant in the U.S. at the time, was released after posting a $5 million bond and agreeing to surrender his passport. Sweeney went out of his way to lambaste Hayes. One defendant went as far as to brag the company incorporated in a jurisdiction outside the U.S. because bribing regulators in that jurisdiction cost just a coconut. He warned that they will soon learn the price of their alleged crimes will not be paid with tropical fruit, but rather could result in fines, restitution, and federal prison time. Rubini had been sounding the alarm for well over a year, and in October, the feds answered. But it was not just the Justice Department. The CFTC, which protects retail and institutional investors from fraud, manipulation, and abusive practices related to the sale of futures and options, filed a civil suit against BitMEX and its founders for operating an unregistered trading platform and failing to implement required anti-money laundering procedures. The criminal case has stunned legal observers. I'm not aware, and I've done this for a really long time, of any other criminal indictment, and certainly not one targeting individuals, that is solely based on anti-money laundering program failures, maintained Laurel Loomis Ramon, an expert in financial crimes who spent 16 years with the Justice Department and prosecuted its very first digital currency case. Now in private practice at O'Melveny and Myers, she advises cryptocurrency and blockchain companies. Like other DOJ veterans I spoke with, she was struck by the absence of more substantive charges. This article will be continued in the next installment. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service and broadcasting from its studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both Parts A and B are available as a podcast. Opening and closing music by Calexico. Interval selection by Mark Hoffman.